Hi, this is Paul, and I want to do another video on frame, God, idolatry, and focus. The last video I did on this topic, I used some footage from Hubert Dreyfus. Now, I'd seen him on some philosophy videos on the internet. I didn't know much about him. Apparently, he was a scholar in Berkeley. He passed away in 2017. Obviously, made a big ripple in the AI community when he was teaching at MIT. And a number of other interesting things about him, especially to this, as John Vervaeke and Savilla King call it, their little corner of the internet with Heidegger and Kierkegaard and some of these issues. Now, the Google engine drew me to this video. Dreyfus, because I had just been looking at videos of his, Heidegger, AI, and meaning. Well, no wonder that Google sent me to this video, and in fact, it was very germane. It's really quite a nice little movie-type video with some good interviews with him. Now, the sound from him isn't that great, and so that's noted in the comments of the video. Not a lot of views on that video, but it's a really good interview, and I want to do some commentary on this interview as it pertains to all the kinds of things I've been talking about. So let's dive in.
That's what we are now, a time in which everybody wants to get the most out of their possibilities, every country, every person. And that's very bad, because that means that you don't really get deeply involved in anything. You stay at the level in which you can manipulate everything, you and other people too.
Now, this is a wonderful little observation about our times, and in many ways I'd say what we are these little godlets. And we imagine we see the world through our monarchical vision, and we look down on it, and we use whatever strength and power that we have in order to create the world we want. In some ways, this is a continuous cosmos, pre-axial age condition with sort of a faux axial age perspective of the monarchical vision. And we imagine we see without filters, and we look to optimize our realization from potential. And that's right now the presumed assumption of what a good life is. And this is promoted in advertising. It's promoted in... It's the subtext of our world. And obviously, it is not in keeping with a religious perspective. It is not in keeping even with many philosophical perspectives. It's sort of, as N.T. Wright calls, this default Epicurean perspective that we have of what life should be.
What they forget, and this is a Kierkegaardian issue, really. I mean, Kierkegaard wrote the book, or a long article, called The Present Age, and that's when he introduced this notion of nihilism, that if you just try to maximize pleasure, or try to be ethical, or try to be mystical religious, you miss what's really important about human beings.
Now notice what he just said. Let's hear that again. Again, the sound quality isn't great, but hopefully you can make it out.
A long article called The Present Age, and that's when he introduced this notion of nihilism.
So Kierkegaard notices nihilism in The Present Age. Now pay attention to these good things that are all good things, but when elevated to ultimate things, they are diminished.
That if you just try to maximize pleasure.
Maximizing pleasure. If you make the maximization of pleasure an ultimate thing, actually, because the maximization of pleasure can't be an ultimate thing, now we're going to be talking a lot about idolatry in this video, because it can't be an ultimate thing, even pleasure itself is diminished. It's not allowed, in a sense, to inhabit the space that pleasure was in Christian terms, created for. If pushed too far, pleasure gives pleasure, but it doesn't give ultimate satisfaction or, let's say, joy.
Or try to be ethical.
Morality. Morality is a vitally important thing. But if morality is what you are ultimately about, well, it too is hollow because it can't fill that space of ultimate importance.
Or try to be mystical.
Mystical experiences. Try to have an experience of attunement and at-one-ment. Even that, if, say, life is all about these experiences. Now, remember, these as experiences. Life is about these experiences. Then that, too, falls short. In a sense, we're reading the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament with Koheleth, the assembler or the teacher, looking at the world and saying, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And Kierkegaard noticed this and called it nihilism because there's a vacuum at the top of the hierarchy and other things are being elevated in order to fill that vacuum.
Religious, you miss what's really important about human beings.
Now even religion as such, if your life is about being religious, that fails to satisfy.
That they should be totally committed to some particular thing.
Okay, so in other words, to address this, Dreyfus is saying in his reading of Kierkegaard that you need to have a monarchical focus, not a monarchical vision. You need to have a singular focus. And once that singular focus takes in, well, then suddenly things work better. But a lot of it depends on what that focus is. And now, again, we're back into the question of a frame, because in a sense what a frame is the focus through which you see everything else in the world. Okay, so if your focus is gaining mystical experiences, that will be the frame through which you will assess opportunities and obstacles in order to achieve that. So that singular focus actually is the way that you process your life, because you cannot be without a focus.
Only then can you be a self that isn't in despair, to talk in Kierkegaard way. And we are in this age now where people are not committed. Don't think that that's unfortunate. You're going to suffer. You are.
Love the Carmen Ghia, by the way, in the video here. But I got distracted by the Carmen Ghia. I better go back and watch it some more.
Now, where people are not committed. Don't think that that's unfortunate. You're going to suffer. You are, and if you live that way.
So in other words, if you don't have a frame through which to see the world, you are going to suffer. And I would assert that if you have the wrong frame, you are going to suffer. Well, the truth is, you're going to suffer anyway. Suffering is guaranteed to come to all of us at one time or another, in one place or another.
You don't find anything in your life that's really fully meaningful and satisfying.
In other words, if you adopt this pseudo-godlet position, above all, being the ultimate, and in many ways, the ultimate consumer, where everything is simply a vehicle towards satisfaction, consumption, experience, if what that means is, in a sense, you are at the top of your hierarchy. And as Kierkegaard noted, ironically, that's a nihilism, because the truth is, you are too small to occupy that spot. You are too weak. You are too short-lived. You are too dim-witted. I mean, and I am too. I mean, there's no exception of that. There's something has happened in the secular world where we have taken up that place of highest importance, me, the center of the world, and now attempts to govern the world and govern my life. And very quickly we realize, well, I don't have enough power. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough smarts. I don't have enough to actually satisfy myself. Myself as a pond is too shallow. Myself as a person is too small. And Kierkegaard notes this.
Kierkegaard says that's the present age, and I think that's right. It is mainly the view of the present age. I think that's what the students come into the course thinking. Maybe if I teach it well enough, Kierkegaard is smart enough, which he certainly is, they come out understanding that they better be committed to something. And those are the ones who come up to me in the supermarket and say, I've changed their lives, of which there's many more than one would have thought. So for Kierkegaard, anyway, you go through the sphere of existence, that is, the way of life, of going for keeping all possibilities open, and then you go from there to a way of life in which you obey the ethical principles and feel satisfied that you're doing the right thing. And then you go through this mystical sort of religious stage in which you try to feel that you're one with in Dante, you're one with the love that moves the sun and the other stars. Kierkegaard has something like it.
Now, if you go back to Paul Maxwell's, and he talked about the different order, I think it was Paul Maxwell's video, different order of Kierkegaard, and how Kierkegaard, in a sense, inverts the philosophers. I think that's what he's talking about now in terms of this progressive, and then we get all the way up until Dante's beatific vision.
That love that moves the sun and the other... In Dante, you're one with the love that moves the sun and the other stars.
That's what we long for. One with the love that moves the sun, the moon, and the stars. If you read C.S. Lewis's Discarded Image, you'll get a very clear picture of that medieval model, that medieval image where God is, in a sense, the greatest outermost sphere that moves, and because of the movement of that sphere, all the other spheres move all the way down here to the world.
Kierkegaard has something like that. I forget what his is. But anyway, and then you get to this thing. You become totally committed to some political cause or to some person or to some idea that tells you who you are.
See, now here's where Dreyfus and I would part ways a little bit, but I think Dreyfus is correct. What happens is that you take this... See, he sees Kierkegaard as saying, well... You arrive at this religious thing, and I would say, okay. And now Dreyfus is saying, and look, that's the goal. You need to have this frame, this focus, and maybe it's a religion, maybe it's a movement, maybe it's an ideology. Now, I would, at this point, say, yeah, unless you have the correct thing at the top of your frame, you're going to always make a religion out of whatever it is you arrive at, and in a sense have this, and this is part of my criticism of Peterson and how he sees meaning itself as an internal compass, and do what's meaningful and not what's expedient. Now, the irony of what Peterson is saying is there's that politically a lot of the groups that he's opposing are in fact doing something that feels to them as incredibly meaningful, because in fact something has moved to the top of their hierarchy. Now, I've been talking about this video, but I hadn't bothered to track down the moment so I could play it in my video. So this morning it was like, okay, it's time to find that clip. And this is from a conversation between Benjamin Boyce and James Lindsay. Now, I've spoken with James Lindsay on my channel. I should probably have him back. And, you know, I should do I owe Peter Boghossian a book review of their book. And I've got some ideas about the book. I have listened to it. I have read it now. And I've listened to some other reviews of it. And so I do want to talk to Peter Boghossian and James about their book. But this was a terrific conversation between Benjamin Boyce and James Lindsay. And I thought it went into... Benjamin Boyce is a tremendous interviewer. He really is. And it's a real gift that he has. And I thought this was a tremendous conversation. And what... There's a spat going on right now, even in Reformed circles, with a pastor who's just south of me in Stockton, and Shenvey, oh, I forget his first name, who's been writing this blog on critical theory, and they've been going back and forth, and you know the conversation basically revolves around the fact that, number one, especially if you're Reformed, racism is part of the package. See my conversation with Benjamin Boyce. Racism is part of the sin package that we all get. It's an almost inevitable manifestation of human dynamics and our propensity to put ourselves at the top of the hierarchy. The church is always going to have to deal with race. What I have seen is that racism itself has now become a pseudo-religion. Racism itself has come at the top of the hierarchy as Dreyfus reads Kierkegaard. Now, and anti-racism itself. And what I noted, see James Lindsay is a very interesting guy. He's as an atheist, he's done a lot of study of religion because he lives in the American South and all of his friends are religious people. So he wants to figure out what is with religion and what makes it tick. So he's done a lot of deconstructing of religion. But now with this whole feud, this schism in the church of atheism between the social justice side and sort of the classical liberal side, James Lindsay has turned his attention to deconstruct them. And so he's a very smart guy. He's read their books. And he makes this observation in the conversation with Benjamin Boyce that I thought was tremendously important and helpful.
Our contention is that, yes, indeed, social justice is postmodern, but it has, in the sense of using postmodern methods, but it's taken up a meta-narrative, which is what postmodernism is supposed to be wholly skeptical of. And that meta-narrative started... I mean, it came from the leftist politics and views that were always buried within, the original French philosophers and sociologists. But it took on a new character in the 1980s and 1990s under the two most prominent figures in this regard would have been Judith Butler working in queer theory, but more importantly, Kimberly Crenshaw working at critical race theory and
legal theory.
She is the progenitor of intersectionality. She came up with that term in a paper in 1989 and then went to town defining and clarifying its need in 1991. And at that point, what happened was, and this is the birth of the meta-narrative, like I said, though, that it came out of previous existing political roots. They said that you can't do political work, and Kimberly Crenshaw is explicit about what kind of political work, identity political work. You can't do identity politics unless if you're willing to deconstruct everything, including identity. So she said, we're going to start by saying that the postmodern thinkers went too far. They have valuable tools that we will employ. They had valuable insights that we should draw upon, but ultimately they were operating from a place of privilege that allowed them to deconstruct even oppression based on identity in particular. And it's a mark of their privilege that prevented them from being able to realize that they were acting in privilege. So you could almost say that Kimberly Crenshaw's big idea would be where you have Descartes trying to drill down. I don't want to maybe blow her up to this big of a stature like Descartes, but who knows? Where you have Descartes drilling down to what's one thing I know I can say is true, and he comes out with cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. Here you have Kimberly Crenshaw drilling down, saying what can I know is true after postmodern deconstruction says that there is no such thing as accessible truth. And she drills down and she says, I am oppressed. Therefore, I am. And so she, following bell hooks, a very famous black feminist at the time, following her, came out with a statement that said, there's a fundamental and important difference, especially if you wish to do identity politics, between the statement, I am black, I take on black identity, versus I am a person who happens to be black, which would be the prevailing liberal colorblind, if you will, interpretation.
You've got a difference there between an essence and an accident.
...of how to deal with the social constructions around race.
Okay. So that amness then provides you an anchor in this postmodern world. So the postmodern world is, everything's constantly being deconstructed. We're in a sea of chaos, and everything that we assemble out of that is tentative at best. Whereas this is trying to say or reserve one space or one, access to objective reality, which is, I guess, the cornerstone also of subjective experience, being one's identity. And insofar as one's identity is oppressed, that magnifies that identity, that makes that identity more real than other identities. Would you say that that's fair?
That's fair. That's correct. It also makes it more salient and something that people need to pay more attention to and focus upon. So yes, it was definitely a sense of saying, you know, we can deconstruct many things using postmodern tools. We can take apart the glue that holds language and meaning, that glues language to meaning, for example. We can dissolve glue that holds these factors of society together even. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that we should not pour any solvent on, the deconstructive solvent, is oppression based on identity, and therefore identity itself, as seen, identity as defined in terms of group membership through which power dynamics have been applied. And then I say group membership, I mean the social construction of the group. Black, for example, contains many populations, if you ask a biologist, mm-hmm. many different distinct populations of human beings that have slightly different and identifiable genetic markers that you could trace back. Different populations, but black skin means black. That's a social construction around around the color of skin, actually. Mm-hmm. And so, or ethnicity, as it were, if their skin happens to be very light, but they happen to be in that lineage. So the one thing that cannot be dissolved is that. So in a sense, you can actually say that this is a process of making something sacred. If you turn back to the religious psychology or the moral psychology, Jonathan Haidt has been very eloquent on talking about the role of sacredness and taboo. That was most of his early social psychology work was in that. And he poses some very disturbing questions if you go read some of his previous books, The Happiness Hypothesis, The Righteous Mind. So what this is a process of making something sacred. Mm-hmm. So identity as defined through socially constructed group membership became a sacred object. And in particular, it was following the kind of thoughts of Derrida, or even following the thoughts of Foucault, who are both obsessed with power. Derrida, how it manifests in language, Foucault, and how language works to maintain and legitimize it. The idea was that those socially constructed groups have to be understood in terms of their oppression versus dominance, a binary of power, what's called a hierarchical binary that contains a power dynamic. And so that was reified in the early 1990s, the late 80s leading up to, and then the early 1990s, such that by probably no later than 1994 or 5, it was pretty entrenched. By early 2000s, you had considerable scholars writing. There's sort of this last gasp, dying gasp for the old forms of scholarship into critical analysis of society, which would have been socialist in orientation. They called them materialist or radical in orientation. But now there's this dying gasp. Like, I remember seeing a paper, a last case for materialist feminism or something like that at one point, or why we need to bring back materialist feminism. And you had people doing postmortems by 2004, 2005, or 2006, where no longer is the old way of thinking how we do things. We now have this intersectional framework, and there's been this massive shift to focusing on identity for the purpose of identity politics. And so what happened for this new crop is generations come and generations go. And the idea sort of is, if you have something that appears to be established as knowledge through the publication in peer-reviewed journals and books and then being taught, and then a generation goes by, that second generation, the child generation, cites the big thinkers from the moment before. And then so then at that point, the canon gets built. And then in the second generation, the grandchild generation starts taking those things for granted. Everybody's known this for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And there you have, now you have your God. You have the one thing that cannot be deconstructed. You have the one frame, in this case, the frame of oppression through which you see the entire world and you organize. Now, the difficulty with intersectionality is that will continue to diminish, because when you look at combinatorial explosion, even with respect to matrices of oppression, it can expand infinitely, and then in a sense you're all the way back down to a group of one. So critical race theorists realize the weakness of pure postmodernism, and so isolates a something to serve as a god, in this case an oppressive identity, or a matrix, or a pathway of identity, or a pathway of oppression, or a history of oppression, and that then becomes the frame. Now, again, in classical Christian terms, that is called idolatry, because you take something here within the created order, doesn't have to be a physical thing, doesn't have to be something that you can lay hands on, but it can even be a theoretical thing, such as a history of oppression. You can objectify it. That then can create the lens through which now you put at the top of your hierarchy and your entire world organizes around it. Now, what's interesting is that, I'm going to go back to the Dreyfus video here, because what we do with these frames is that we create worlds. Now, animals inhabit this sort of half world, according to our perspective. All kinds of things we can do in front of our dogs and cats, and they don't really care, because the meaning and significance of them is, well, it's at our level, it's not at the dog and cat level. The dog and cats have particular frames that are very limited to survival, and this is why they're so easily colonized, that we can, in a sense, we are more real than our pets, and we can colonize them quite easily. And in fact, the entire history of domestication of animals is an example of this. But now, in a sense, what the celebrity atheists want to do is take that half world and say, that's the dominant world. Well, it really isn't, because it's all these other things, these theoretical things, these things of heaven that we humans can, you kind of have the axial, an image of the axial split here, all these things of heaven that we use to colonize and dominate the things in this half world, well, we're masters at that, and the animals are not. So we thoroughly colonize not only animals and plants, but raw materials and all of these sorts of things. We colonize them thoroughly. Now, again, if you read C.S. Lewis's Miracles, Lewis uses rationality as the language of, in a sense, the top half of the axial split, the axial divide. And God then is the source of all rationality, and we express it and we use it. And if you go back to the previous video, if you look at, you know, rationality is related to this being a rational agent, one who can, in terms of the life of the mind, imagine outcomes, and so manipulate tools and power and work things here in order to achieve outcomes. And within that, you have the sense of will, you have the sense of desire. I'm probably going to be doing a lot more with Rene Girard as things move forward, because I've been listening to him quite a bit lately, and he's colonizing me. So I've been finding a lot, actually. Probably going to post this after my conversation with Craig Stewart. I had that conversation yesterday. So what they don't realize is that these tools that we use are really limited in even for what we normally enjoy, and that we have this world creating capacity. So let's hear Dreyfus talk about these worlds, and here he's going to hang on, I'm going to have to find. I hate when I forget to put in the. I think it's 14. That's why I take the screenshot. Here we go.
Well, that's interesting. Well, then we have to go back and think about what it is to disclose a new world. One of the things will help us understand, perhaps, what this relation to authentic running forward into death, what that could be like, is to ask about what people have when they have worlds. Animals don't have worlds. Heidegger says animals are world poor.
See, animals are world poor, what people have when they have worlds. Now, if you're paying attention to these frames, these frames are part of our process of creating worlds. And these frames focus, remember Peterson always says, well, see, opportunities and obstacles. These frames focus what is an opportunity and what is an obstacle, because implicit in every frame is a telos, okay? It's a goal, it's a final purpose, or it's a final cause. It's the thing that directs us and orients to something far beyond itself. Now, as I continue to get into René Girard, one of the things that happens with this mimetic theory is that, well, where do we get these desires from? And not just our instinctual desires that can be fairly easily satisfied. Again, watch Mary Cohen's video on Verveke and satisfaction and desire and appetite. It was really a great video. But we have these desires, and so we desire something. And actually what we do is we desire through others. We see glory in another, and we don't just desire to have that glory. We desire to replace that other. And this is exactly, so some of you know where I'm going with this, that God is in fact the frame of all frames. What happens in Genesis 3 is that we see God and we desire to replace God. And, well, that happens as in terms of when we see God, and that is, in fact, idolatry. Now, what tends to happen, you can look at it through the lens of, let's say, the book of Romans in the New Testament, Romans 1. We replace other things below for God. And so, in a sense, if we take on the frame of oppression, well, it's a sort of strange frame, and it's a frustrating frame, because my identity then becomes one of oppressed, but the very nature of that and the type of frame it is says, well, we should seek the end of oppression. But if we arrive at the end of oppression, I lose my identity because of my frame, okay? And so the frame of oppression has created a world in which, well, I am bound to frustration, because the degree to which the implicit telos, the good telos of the frame, which is end of oppression, is realized, I lose my identity. I lose the ground upon which my entire life is built. And now, as I talked with John Verveke in my conversation with him, there are many cases of this. I keep looking around for the book, and actually the Tim Keller book is here, Counterfeit Gods, which deals with this question of idols and things that we use to displace God. So let's say we take a good thing like family and turn it into an ultimate thing. Actually, if you make your family the goal of your life, you will destroy your family, because family is too weak a thing to actually construct a world upon. Romantic love, as I mentioned with John Verveke, you make romantic love the goal of your life, you are too small if you make the goal to be the object of romantic love, or the pursuit of romantic love. Well, as C.S. Lewis notes, all deaths in this world end, and all loves in this world end in death or betrayal. That's how it works, and it can't be any other way. So there's a problem with these frames. And so, as now Dreyfus and following Heidegger said, well, we're world makers. The animals don't make these worlds. We make these worlds. And the problem is, if the frame that you're using to make a world is from something within this world, you are setting yourself up for suffering and frustration, because, at least this is the biblical assertion of the Apostle Paul, that nothing in this world can bear that weight, because actually, unlike the animals, we are, C.S. Lewis calls us amphibious. We get into this word spiritual, which is this upper end of the axial divide. The animals aren't there. We are there. And the difficulty is, if you take anything beneath in the animal or below layer in this world and make that your frame, even, let's say, a history of oppression or the desire for romantic love or anything within this world, you make that your frame, you are making a, less than adequate world and a world that will be bent towards ultimate frustration and disaster. And the biblical terminology for that is, in fact, idolatry.
We have a world, each of us, and there's a shared world, too, that we all have. And creative people can disclose new worlds, I do think. And I think that's right. And it's hard to understand what it is to be a creative person and disclose new worlds, but it's got to do with having a completely new take on something important that people have all gotten wrong, and which you have this kind of moment of aha if you get it right.
Now, in terms of idolatry, what I'm saying, and this is really complicated and sort of hard to get your head around, there are frames and subframes. And there's only one thing that is legitimate, the main frame. And if you have that main frame, you can have lots of subframes. And that affords exactly what Heidegger is saying. Because, well, Tolkien called us sub-creators. So if there is the creator, we can be sub-creators, because what we do and what we're built for is actually to take the things of this world and from them make glory. This is what's called the cultural mandate in the beginning of the book of Genesis, that be fruitful and multiply and have dominion over the earth. Now, this dominion is not intended to be an exploitative dominion, but a fruitful, glory-making dominion. And so what Heidegger is looking at here is this mandate that we've been given to find things in the world and make worlds out of them. And we do that all the time. We make worlds of music. We make worlds of culinary arts. We make worlds of psychology. We make worlds of philosophy. We make worlds of family life. We make worlds of community life. We make worlds in art. We make worlds in all sorts of things. And that world making is, in fact, says Genesis 1, what we are made for. Because in a sense, part of why we're made, we are made for glory. We are made to basically do what the God does and multiply it. And that's part of the reason we find so much joy in it. That's part of the reason glory is this powerful idea. Back to God 1 and God 2. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. God number 2, the whole earth is full of his glory. It's built in. It's that God is the system of all systems. And so what we do is we, being the mirror of both God number 2 and God number 1, we act like God number 2, come into this world, make worlds out of it for our enjoyment, the enjoyment and flourishing of the community, and for the glory of the original God.
Invented about 5 totally new, just different ways of having a world and having activities, and that's pretty amazing.
And that's what we are made to do. We are made to make worlds. Now, but we don't realize that these tools now. What we get into then is this idea of rules and rationality. Now, I don't know if I'm remembering the video. I'll let it play a little bit more.
And that's what it would be like in a localish way to disclose new worlds. But there are big deal ways to disclose new worlds. So people talk about Einstein, or they talk about Descartes, for instance. So in a certain way, he's a bad guy. In a certain way, he's a big deal discloser of modernity. It's just modernity may not be such a nice thing to disclose. But so what am I saying? That you need to know about what it is is to disclose worlds in order to understand what it is to lose worlds, too. It's true that to disclose a world, you've got to give up the previous one. It was some kind of misunderstanding. When I was something like discovering the world, that's different than my brother. We each did it, but in a different disclosing of a different world. So with me, I, at MIT, I came to MIT to teach at just the time when everybody was interested in computers and believed that we would...
Okay, I'm going to jump ahead to the next point. Now, rationality, again, we talked a little bit about the celebrity atheist. Rationality itself, his last point that he makes in this video, doesn't really get you there, because this consciousness is an extremely powerful tool. And within consciousness, we can marshal intentionality, and we can focus action, and these are extremely powerful tools. But now in this last segment, he notes that in a really strange way, this tool can't even get us as far as common things in our life demonstrate to us. It doesn't work for driving, it doesn't work for basketball. Let's look at this last, let's see if I put the link in here. Yeah.
But everybody gets to be, if they're hardworking and take risks and so forth, an expert at something, or a master if you really want to go all the way. And it's something that, since everybody has had this experience, it's odd that philosophers never explained the experience. Worse, they totally misexplained it. That's why they misunderstood the computers and thought they could be intelligent. They thought being intelligent was having the right rules in your mind and the right descriptions in your mind.
Now again, go back to the Jordan Peterson, Matt Dillahunty video, and maybe one of these days I should play that one in here. But that's exactly the nexus of their disagreement, that Dillahunty is saying, well, what we can do is we can take the world and we can make it into objects, and then we can manipulate these objects, and with this manipulation and with rationality, we have the power to construct for ourselves the world of our desires. And Jordan Peterson says, not anywhere near, not anywhere close. And here, Dreyfus is basically making the same point.
And in fact, it wasn't like that at all. And then he has it. The first stage, it's true, you need rules.
I'll give an example from chess and from driving. Chess is very disembodied, I think. Driving is obviously very embodied. Both of them equally have the same 5 or 6 stage structure. I say 6 because my brother doesn't like this stage. His work stopped at this stage. And master is really like world discloser. It's so, being a mathematician, he does.
Now he's got a 6-step thing that he has written on the blackboard for those of you who are just listening. First stage is novice. Second stage is advanced beginner. Third stage is competence. Fourth stage is proficiency. I can't read the 5th stage. Might be efficiency or expertise or something like that. And then the 6th stage is master. These are the stages that he's talking about. And he's pointing to the board. And this sounds a little bit better in this part because they've switched format and they fixed the sound.
Like something that's not very clear. So that back here...
5th stage is expertise.
All this thinking is going to get in your...
Competence, advanced beginners, and novice. Stages 1 through 3 he's pointing to.
Way. So that back here, all this thinking is going to get in your way. Even here, the
proficiency
isn't going to be the way an expert thinks. An expert doesn't think. He just does what works and what has normally worked for him, and it will normally work.
Now this is... John Ortberg, who's a pastor in Menlo Park Presbyterian, was, in a sense, did for Dallas Willard what I'm doing for a series of people through my videos, okay? In some ways, that's how you can understand my project in parallel to what John Ortberg did for Dallas Willard. And Dallas Willard said there's a difference between trying and training. And what we actually do, a lot, this is a fairly popular phrase in Christianity right now in some circles. It's called Christian formation. And it means what we do all the time is that we train, we embody. And this really gets into a lot of Verveke's work in terms of his idea of play, where we're training and we're molding ourselves. And so it's not that our greatest achievement comes simply through what we're able to do in this conscious space, but you get into a flow state. And in fact, you get into communal flow states. And it's not technically the kind of rationality that some celebrity atheists want to point to and say, well, this is our highest state. No, in fact, it isn't our highest state, because when you're thinking, after you've become a proficient driver, thinking about driving as you're thinking about it can muck up your driving. And I think actually a better illustration of this is shooting a basketball. And for sports people, they create all of this muscle memory. You look at a quarterback in the NFL, they don't have time to sit there and think. But their brain, and when we say think in this term, we mean consciously going through a whole bunch of steps. But they are, in fact, thinking. Their brain is, in fact, working. And they have, in some ways, transcended the limitation of the individual self, and in this flow state become one with what's happening in the field, and they get into the flow and they simply act. And I think part of the reason we enjoy watching high-level basketball or football, or for y'all Canadians over there, hockey or whatever sport you're into, part of the reason, or fast chess, part of the reason we like that is because part of us recognizes the flow state and to a degree participates in it. It's like we like watching dancing, because all of these highly integrated body and mind and he's going to get into that at the end of this segment here, because it's very much body and mind. It's heaven and earth. The Bible is about the unification of heaven and earth. And in fact, what happens in Genesis 3 is the division, the divorce, the splitting, the alienation of heaven and earth. And so we actually achieve what we feel we're meant to achieve when we're in that space, when body and mind come together purely, and the conscious rationality, this space in which we're sort of walking through steps, gives way to this flow state, and off we go. And that's really what he's talking about in this segment.
And so in chess, a master chess player or an expert chess player just can make within a few seconds a high level move, and that's what's exciting about expertise. And in driving, you just automatically, your foot comes up from the gas or goes on the brake, and if you start thinking about why you should do this or when you should do this, you stop doing it well. That's that kind of thoughtful reflection is in the way of expertise. Now that's important, because that's what I consider sort of the breakthrough. I mean, for 300 years at least, which is how long it's been since Descartes, or maybe even for 1,000 years, philosophers have thought that the more thinking you do, the more analysis you do, the better the performance will be. And what Stuart, just contemplating driving and chess, two things he knows how to do like an expert, saw that that's extremely wrong. All this thinking about,
again, stages 1, 2, and 3, he's pointing out,
what to do and memorizing what to do is getting in the way of the spontaneous doing. Of course, you can't just start that way. You've got to have lots of experience, take risks, lose sometime, win sometime. But if you do all that, and you do...
That's the training versus trying, or it's really, in a sense, training versus this sort of rational, intentional thinking within a conscious frame that's one step upon another, that so occupies our monofocal consciousness field.
Do it a lot. Then you can get to the point where you don't think anymore. And then you're really good. Then that's what the chess expert does. He just sees the right move and makes it. You can make it, you can play blitz chess if you're a master, which means you can make a move in about 3 seconds or something after you see the previous move, and you're still be playing at master level, and you won't be thinking at all. So there's something higher, namely intuition, that you have to have, which is leading you to see the situation in such a way that it draws you immediately to do the appropriate thing.
Now I really want to be careful with this move he makes here, because it's made often, and it's made in sort of this, what do they call it, a Mary Jane move in terms of one of the Star Wars movies, that intuition. Well, intuition that has been honed and formed and worked through. It's the intuition of the master, not the intuition of the novice. Because the novice has plenty of intuition, but they have no skill. That intuition, in a sense, has not been trained. And this is where, in a sense, rationality and intuition come together, the left and the right brain. This is where they're actually working together, and it's all coming together. And so I don't want to just simply say intuition, because it's really this trained, honed, formed, practiced intuition. Somebody runs onto a basketball court and starts just chucking up shots. Well, that's intuition. LeBron comes onto the basketball court and starts shooting. Well, that's training, and that's training and intuition, and it all flows together.
And then there's something harder to describe, which my brother did. This is the revelation that philosophers have been 180 degrees wrong for the whole history of philosophy, thinking that rules and facts and reflection was the way to become intelligent and expert. All you needed to do is just pay attention to your own experience. The reason Stuart could do it is he's never read a philosophy book in his life at that point. He maybe has read some since. He was a mathematician, an applied mathematician. He had to just look at what he was doing when he was driving and what he was doing when he was playing expert level chess. And he did, and he saw this, and it changed. It didn't change the whole world, but it did change a lot of the way people learned a lot of skills that are now sort of devoted to repeating his views about these things. And it sort of turned the idea about how the mind works when you're an expert upside down. And that, to me, from inside philosophy, was a big revelation. And then I realized that Heidegger was onto that. Heidegger talks about how when you have to become skilled in dealing with the world, and when you are, you're absorbed. That's his word. You're absorbed in the situation. So if you're a carpenter, you could be an expert carpenter. But if you're really, really a good carpenter, you will just, the hammer withdraws, Heidegger says. The hammer
And this isn't this in a sense is, again, the reunion of heaven and earth, because it's the union of mind and body. And I don't mean brain and body. Brain and body are always united, but mind and body. And again, it's what we were talking about.
It disappears, and you sort of disappear into this activity. And that's, we are the kind of being that's absorbed. They can be absorbed in what they're doing, and when they are, it brings them out at their best. That's the moral of this skill story.
But of course, you need to be absorbed in the right thing, because someone who is trying to weaponize smallpox or something like this, they can be absorbed in that. And And again, this is the weakness of Jordan Peterson's meaning as internal compass. Do what is meaningful. Well, maybe weaponizing smallpox feels meaningful, or maybe writing some mass shooter manifesto feels meaningful. Meaning in and of itself won't necessarily lead to, see, the goal is not just me flourishing, which would be solipsistic, me all by myself. The goal is all of heaven and earth flourishing. That's what Christianity seeks. It's the flourishing of heaven and earth. So let's get this next up. So God is the ultimately productive frame in Christianity, because if it's just, again, about my meaning and my flow, well, that's going to leave everyone else, in a sense, in isolation. Now, how does this work? Well, God is the frame of all frames. And if you go all the way back to the beginning of the video that I've been playing through this of Dreyfus, God is the one thing, and connecting it to the James Lindsay Benjamin Boyce, God is the one thing you don't deconstruct. Well, see, that's not actually true, because if you listen to Rene Girard in the CBC interviews, which are just tremendous, I'll put a link to them below if I remember, and if I don't remember, just leave a comment and then I'll put a link in the comments. But God is this weird frame that includes everything, in a sense, except evil. All right? So it's the good of all goods. It's the frame of all frames. And as Kierkegaard and Dreyfus, following Kierkegaard, notes, you cannot be happy. You will be subject to nihilism unless you are devoted to something. But now again, you can be devoted to all kinds of things. But any other thing within this world that you are devoted to will lead your life towards an inevitable frustration and disaster. And actually what hell is, if you read C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, what hell is people taking lesser frames and refusing to give up on them. And you can, in fact, find people in C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce focusing on a frame of having been oppressed, or focusing on a frame of having been hurt, or focusing on a frame of somebody else's hurt or harm. And what hell is people who are so, they've simply become their lesser frame. And as C.S. Lewis says, they began by grumbling, and that formation kicked in, and all they became was a grumble. They're not even a frame anymore. They've just become this tiny little minimalist frame. And in fact, I would assert that you can watch people, if you know people over long periods of time, you can watch this happen in people's lives. They start out being bitter, and their bitterness just makes them smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So they start out being a bitter person, and all they wind up being is bitterness. And this is very much an image of hell. And C.S. Lewis points this out in his book, The Great Divorce. So you must devote yourself to something, but then the question is, what? Well, I find this satisfying. Okay, devote yourself to that. But if you make that your God, you are going to have a problem. And so what God is, the frame of all frames. And because this God is above everything that's below here, again, this is Paul following Paul in the book of Romans, the first chapter of Romans. If you follow God and make and have God be the frame of all frames and devote yourself to God, as C.S. Lewis says, you put first things first and you'll have room for everything else. Because within God, you actually can see. C.S. Lewis says, God is the sun, and through which, it's the beam of light, through which I can see the rest. And now, if God is the frame of all frames, you can participate in other frames and enter even in flow states in other frames, but it won't destroy you. If you make your oppression your main frame, the oppression matrix that you, by virtue of your birth or by virtue of your experience, have been subject to, well, as I said before, if you make that your frame, that becomes your identity. And what you actually do is perpetuate the oppression, because the oppression has to, you have to keep being able to find the oppression, because once you stop finding it, you lose the frame through which you see your life and you lose your identity. And that's why oppression is, in fact, an idolatry, and it's a dead end, and it leads to hell. And that's how Christian theology leads. You ask, well, what is hell? Well, it's a multi-layered thing. Hell is what happens if you take a lesser frame. And despite, and again, C.S. Lewis plays this out with the angels trying to talk people out of their frames. You persist in saying, this is my frame. This leads to hell. And it leads to hell on earth. And Lewis, of course, believes that, well, with Kierkegaard and many others, that, well, if in fact you are an everlasting being and you live forever and you maintain that frame, well, you are just always going to maintain that frame. And what happens is your frame will get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller because you are not that big. So you must devote yourself to something, and if you give your heart primarily to something, you can give your heart secondarily to whole ranges of things in a very healthy, safe way, because your heart is primarily focused on the one thing that cannot be corrupted, the one thing that is deep enough to include all. And that's where God number one comes in. The whole earth is full of his glory. If you devote yourself to God, you will love your neighbor as yourself. You will love the animals. You will love the creation. You can love nature. You can love music. You can love everything that is within God's creation that has not been horribly twisted. You can love that eternally. And what that means is that, in a sense, the beatific vision, once you love the lover, you love everything the lover loves. And in fact, then in the new creation, you can devote yourself to science or to animals or to music or to wine or to all kinds of things, because it's all within the one frame. Okay? If you devote yourself to anything in this world, you will be less than that thing. Because again, we are made to, the animals are down here. We are made with this other capacity to be above them, to be able to colonize them, to be able to, but not colonize them in an exploitive way, but colonize them in a way that creates more glory. And so domestication of animals should bring the glory out of them and manifest the glory that's present within them. Now, as we do that today, I look at my tiny little dog at home and think, that thing came from a wolf? But there's a certain degree of glory that my little dog has that a wolf doesn't have. Now, there's also a degree of diminishment that my dog has, not just in size than the wolf, and that again is part of the fact that we are broken, fallen creatures, and everything we do is diminished. We are poor sub-creators, but we are made to finally be glorious sub-creators that can, in increasing measure, manifest and realize the glory of the frame of all frames. As the book of Hebrews says, you're made a little lower than the angels. If you devote yourself to God, God assigns you flexibly to serve everything in this world. Now, you look at Jesus Christ and you read the Gospels. Jesus is the servant of all. Well, what does that mean? That means that God, who is, in a sense, the frame of all frames, is also, in another way, invisible. God is so humble, he doesn't keep intruding into the glory project. I've made this illustration in a number of places. If there is a baker who makes the most glorious cakes that you can know, what that baker does is puts the cakes out there and enjoys watching the glory of the cake do its thing. And others want to be like the baker because of the glory, but the baker holds back and watches. If the baker were to be less humble and intrusive, the baker would say, that's my cake, that's my cake, that's my cake. What the God does is say, no, the glory is all over the world, and I give it to you freely, and I want to see what you're going to do with it. I want to see you as my child take the things of this world and make them glorious. Take wheat and take sugar and take color and take all of the, and take milk and take all of this artistry and make a glorious cake. Take sound vibrations and make glorious music. I want you to make glory in this world, and I will enjoy you enjoying me. That's the Christian vision. So God assigns you flexibility, but in order to do this, you must be the servant of all. And you must, in fact, be making glory in a very humble way, so that the glory is not diminished, and so that you give glory to others. So you, in order to have the frame of all frames, you become the servant of all. And this is exactly what Jesus teaches his disciples. And if you do this, just as he does with Christ, this is Philippians 2, God takes the servant of all, and this is how God works with these, inverting these hierarchies, takes the greatest of all, becomes the servant of all, and once again becomes the greatest of all. And that is, in fact, the path that we follow, having the frame of all frames as our primary frame, and then being able to play in all of the other frames. Because if you make one of these other frames the dominant frame, that frame begins to colonize you. And again, that's called idolatry. So you can become a master. And this is a gift of the Spirit. And this is trying formation. This is what happens in the practice and the play of the Christian life, that bit by bit by bit, the stuff gets into you and you become like the Christ. That's the goal of the Christian life, of becoming like Christ. And that is, in a sense, Christianity. And it's not necessarily your rational control, and this is something you learn in the Christian life, because you think, okay, this is how I'm going to live my life. And with that kind of planning, it's sometimes the case that what slips into that planning is another little frame from below here, and that frame starts to dominate. And so what God does is he breaks you out of that frame, usually by bringing suffering into your life, and says, no, I am going to make a new frame for you. Make me the frame of all frames, and I will help you to learn how to make glory, which is built into all of the stuff I have made the world through. I think that's my last slide. So, let me know what you think.